Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Dublin is one of Ohio's wealthier suburbs. Great schools, restaurants, shopping, the kind of place people want to live and developers want to build. But how much control should Dublin have over that development? Strict city codes, stringent design standards, an overall requirement to build structures that are, quote, distinctively Dublin? One developer says the city has gone too far, repeatedly rejecting its plans to renovate Dublin Village Center. They've sued, claiming the city is elitist and uses vague language in its code to arbitrarily reject projects. Dublin says lots of developers have found success within their strict city code, and these rules make it a better place to call home. We're spending the next hour dissecting the Dublin lawsuit and how much control a city should exert over development. We begin with John Bush, a staff writer for Columbus Business First, who's been covering the litigation. Welcome to All Sides, John.
Thanks for having me.
The lawsuit centers around Dublin Village Center. It's a shopping center off Sawmill Road in the city's Bridge Street District. Stavroff, the developer, bought the center in 2009 and has been trying to redevelop the site ever since. But they haven't been successful.
They have not, no.
What is going on?
As far as I know, the lawsuit is still ongoing. They filed basically saying that the city violated their private property rights for a property that they own and have tried to redevelop. And the developer has tried multiple times, submitted multiple plans. It's been rejected, I think, three times over the last 10, 15 years. And at this point, it's kind of at a standstill. And the city argues that it's within their rights to reject whatever proposal that they wish. And the developer is arguing that they are using arbitrary language and things like that in order to deny it just because it's not exactly what they want.
And you've also written that, I mean, the Stavroff, this case here, is the extreme of this question, but you've written that other developers have said Dublin is a difficult place to build.
Yeah, I talked with multiple developers for a broader story I wrote about developing in Dublin, which really stemmed from that lawsuit, that Stavroff lawsuit. And I heard people both on the record and off the record tell me as much that it's, I believe one developer I quoted in that story said it's the most difficult city in Central Ohio that he's attempted to develop in. But I also talked to others that have been successful there and have successfully done projects. So I guess it really just kind of depends. But I think from what I've gathered in my reporting, that seems to be the consensus that it can be a very difficult place to develop.
Yeah, my favorite quote from your reporting was that it's called Dublin for a reason, because your fees, your costs to get it off the ground are double what they might be in other
Dublin,
locations.
Yep, that's right. That's right, yeah.
I did like that, but practically speaking, I mean, the idea that it costs $200,000 to get a major project off the ground, that's not chump change.
No, it's not. And an attorney that represents a lot of these developers I spoke with was the one who told me that, and he would know because he's had experience with that. And it is not common, both the time it takes and the money it takes just to get through the process, let alone actually develop a project. He said that in other communities, you know, it can be maybe half of that. So I think that was really important to contextualize kind of what makes it so difficult there as opposed to other communities in the region.
But difficult, strict, hard to get through does not mean illegal.
Correct.
And that's ultimately what the lawsuit is going to try to determine.
Correct. Yes, that's what they're actively litigating right now. Like I said, I believe the case is still ongoing, so we'll see where it goes. But yes, that is the question. Is the city argues that they're within their legal rights to do so, and the developer says that no, they're not. And again, like you said, he's pointing to these, what he describes as arbitrary standards of distinctly Dublin and these interim land use principles that they've come up with recently to, you know, in his words, you know, deny any project that they wish.
I want to get into what it means to be distinctively Dublin in just a moment, but I do want to say that Matt Stavroff, the developer whose company brought this lawsuit, declined to join us today, as did the city of Dublin. So we asked, they said no, and that's sometimes just how it goes.
Yep, I know that well.
Yeah. So what does it mean to be distinctively Dublin? Because sometimes in development code, you'll see something like that, mm-hmm. and then you'll see a whole bunch of rules that sort of define what that means. What's going on here with Dublin?
I'm not sure. I've never really found a definition, and I think it's one of those things that you could ask 10 people and they'd all have different answers. So I think that it kind of boils down to the crux of the argument is when you say something like distinctly Dublin, what does that mean exactly and how do you define that? I think is kind of the main question is it could be a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
And in different parts of the city. I mean, when you look at the historic district, right, it has a certain aesthetic. It has a certain vibe. Even the chain stores have more muted color palettes and storefronts that seem to conform with the age of the community. But then you go across the river, and it's all big, square, boxy, glass, new construction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the other thing. They have... In addition to the broader standards for the entire city, there are also standards for different parts of the city. So you mentioned historic Dublin has its own set of standards. The Bridge Street District, where Bridge Park is, has its own standards. So it's not only standards for the city itself, but like you said, different. It depends on where you're trying to build, and then you have to adhere to those standards as well.
We also want to hear from you this hour. If you think distinctively Dublin is a fine standard, if you have concerns about development codes in your own communities, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides at wosu.org. You know, I was thinking a lot about this. So I live up in Delaware, so not Dublin.
Okay.
But growing very fast. Mm. And one of the complaints you see up in Delaware in particular is, oh, the Planning Commission says yes to everything. They put no restrictions. They're just building all this stuff with no sense of what it's going to look like. Mm. And I think that's kind of the opposite of what you might hear in Dublin. And I'm not saying that all those claims are true. I'm not making a comment about the Planning Commission.
Sure.
But it does seem it's a lot easier to get projects done there as opposed to Dublin. And it is interesting just to see in Central Ohio, where there is so much growth, how all these different cities are handling that development request.
Yeah, and that's why it's been so interesting for me covering development in the suburbs is, you know, I cover... every, you know, county that touches Franklin, basically, and the rest of Franklin County outside of the city of Columbus. So you're right, every community is different. I think I have noticed that in Delaware, that it seems to be easier to get things through than it is in a community like Dublin. So it really just boils down to that specific community and the officials that are on the city council, the planning commission, et cetera, and what they want to see happen in their communities. And but at the end of the day, it's a public process and residents have their say as well. And I think that's what Dublin argues is that, you know, they make it such a process because they want to get it right and they want to give their residents time to have input. So it's really fascinating depending on where you are in Central Ohio, the types of developments you see and the ease of which to get that through.
Yeah, I think also a lot of what you see up in Delaware County is right now residential construction, mm-hmm. loads and loads.
Absolutely.
Of large-scale housing developments.
Yes, they are. I feel like I write about one every week or two, it seems like.
As someone who lives up there, there's one going up every week or two.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, there's a lot of farmland, agricultural land. There's a lot of land to build on up there. So I think that's why you're seeing that is there's available land. And there's, like you said, there's also, it seems to be a willingness. And don't get me wrong, you know, I've listened to meetings where there has been pushback. So it's not to say that they're just going to, you know, approve every single thing that comes across their desk. But if you're comparing it to a community like Dublin, you know, it can be a little bit easier. And I feel like, again, that's, you know, partly because of, you know, what Delaware wants to see. And that is, again, going back to the officials that are overseeing that process.
Goes back to that whole vision for your city.
Yeah, you know, every city has a master plan. They have a vision, you know, a visioning document or what have you, and they re-examine that, you know, periodically, some, you know, more often than others. But there is, a master planning process that, that those officials, adhere to or go back to and look at. So that's something that, I think just about every community has.
Yeah, you even see it here in Columbus. Like German Village has very strict design codes.
Yes, they do. I live very close to that. I'm, and one of my colleagues actually lives there and has said as such. So yeah, even specific neighborhoods, not just specific cities, have their own standards.
And, you know, when you talk about design codes and ordinances and rules, it can be everything from how many trees to how close the buildings are, how many stories, what kind of materials, the front-facing aesthetics, whether you need sidewalks. Like, it really does cover everything about how a community is going to look.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Anything you could think of. You know, I've poured through these, these documents and you have whole sections on trees. You have whole sections on setbacks. You know, it really is comprehensive in every community. But that's what was so interesting about looking in Dublin is like, taking that to, even more complex and more, there's always a lot of pages of documents and all of these, applications and these approvals and whatnot. But there's even more so in places like Dublin that, understandably, want to be careful because, it is, they understand that they're growing as well and want to see it done right. But yes, it is a very comprehensive process.
Yeah. And it's, they're not the only city in the country with a very comprehensive process. I used to live in Annapolis, Maryland, and I covered the city government there and the number of hours that I spent in like historic district, like subcommittee meetings about every little detail.
Yeah.
Because, the town, the city is, largely where our country was founded, where Washington resigned his commission to the army. You're looking at cobblestone streets that like Jefferson walked upon, and they are super persnickety about preserving that. And you get it, but you also know that if you want to try and put a restaurant in downtown, you're not going to get away with sort of neon colors and blaring signs.
Right, yeah. And again, it's both sides of the coin. You see the point of, like, especially in a historic place, as you mentioned, they want to keep that history intact as much as they can. But at the same time, it's 2024 and things have changed since, the 1700s or the 1800s. So, you kind of have to weigh, growth and development and change with, trying to keep your history intact. And it's a complex and a difficult situation.
In some ways, I think these development codes kind of remind me of HOAs in a way. Like, sometimes they're very specific, right? You can only have these colors. But sometimes HOAs are just like, you have to maintain, like, the appearance of the neighborhood. And you're like, what the heck does that mean?
Yeah, maintain the, again, that's going back to the whole distinctly thing. It's like, well, what does that mean to me? What does that mean to your neighbor? What does that mean to the person across the street? So I think that's really what developers are looking for is just kind of, consistency, of a standard of like spelled out, like this is exactly what we're looking for. And if you have a commission of, five people, again, that distinctness, that appearance, that whatever it is could mean something different.
Yeah, that's at the heart of this lawsuit. So Stavroff, the developer, wants the Dublin Bridge Street District Code declared unconstitutional. Their attorney, Joe Miller, has called Dublin zoning a, quote, scheme and has said the city has given itself absolute discretion to block residential developments for any reason or no reason at all. So, obviously, we've been saying the lawsuit is ongoing, but it really does get at the heart of how do we define these things. It's fine to say distinctively Dublin, but does that mean, like, building height? Does that mean construction materials? Does that mean sidewalks and trees and setbacks?
I mean, just about everything. Yeah. it depends on what part that you're building in, because it could be easier in another area than it is, say, like in the historic district or the Bridge Street district. I would say in terms of like design, architectural, and things like that, it is obviously more of a concern for officials when it is, when you're talking about like a historic district or something like that. Again, it just really depends on where you are. But I would say just about every application a developer's filed, those things do come up. And height and density, you know, versus sprawl, that's a concern everywhere.
Oh my gosh. Yeah,
Ohio.
Columbus is going through the whole zone in process. Yeah.
Yes.
I want to take a call from Mike in Upper Arlington. He's an environmental geologist. Welcome to All Sides, Mike.
Thanks for having me on. In my profession, I work a lot with developers who not only convert farmland into new builds, but also those that go into urban areas, especially sites that are contaminated, and then return them to productive use. One of the things that we do constantly is look at series of historical aerial photographs. As a resident of Franklin County, it's been a bit like the proverbial frog sitting in water that's being slowly heated until it's boiling. We don't, you know, I haven't noticed the development as much as most people would as a rule, just as a local citizen, until I pull out a series of photographs. You know, we look at them starting at 1938. But when you hit about the 1970s in these series, it's, you know, the bucolic pastoral landscape that I recall. But all of a sudden, it accelerates. You can even just hop on Google Earth and look at the historic aerial function and flip through the past 30 years or so. And it is stunning. And here's where I'm going with this. The thing about unbridled development is we cut ourselves off from resources that are really necessary. For example, water supplies. We here in Ohio, a little more than 50% of us rely on groundwater for drinking water, City of Columbus included. But we constantly are turning what used to be recharge zones into parking lots and mini malls and things like that. I'm not going to mention a community, but there's one south of us that had a great well field. Upstream from them was their recharge zone. They gave way to development. They converted all these excellent farm fields into a giant shopping mall. And now that shopping mall is almost dead, but they lost an enormous amount of recharge. When they needed to expand their well field, they were at capacity. They had to leave the community and drill in another community, which created all kinds of conflict. But there are just physical limits to development.
Yeah. You know, Mike, I think that's a really excellent point. And John, I'd love to get your take on that, because it is, I mean, as communities grow, their need for water, their need for electricity, their need for all those kinds of resources continue to climb.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a big thing that's going on all across Central Ohio. We just had a story about all the data centers that are coming in and their electricity demands.
Huge pull on the electrical
grid. Yeah, and not to mention the fact that the population is growing significantly all across the region. So that is a big consideration you have to weigh, because in order to ensure that you have the services that you need for the citizens of your community, that there is enough infrastructure in place, water, sewer, electricity, all of those sorts of things, in order to sustain that. So I think that is a big thing that City of Columbus is weighing, every community across the region is weighing, even out into the outlying areas, like I said, where a lot of these data centers are being put up, and how do we ensure that we have the capacity to handle this growth on both the commercial and residential side.
That was John Bush, a staff writer for Columbus Business First, who's been covering the litigation over what it means to be distinctively Dublin. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And definitely check out his articles. They were very easy to understand and follow. So
great.
Kudos.
I appreciate that. Thanks.
Coming up, a top zoning attorney in Central Ohio is going to explain how cities thwart their projects. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. How much control should a city have over development within its borders? One developer says Dublin exercises too much control, and its lawsuit alleges as much. The city says it has high standards for what is built to ensure that it remains, quote, distinctively Dublin. We're exploring how zoning codes and those who enforce them shape the world in which we live. Joining us now is attorney Aaron Underhill. He's a managing partner of Underhill & Hodge, LLC. He's not involved in the Dublin lawsuit, but he has represented developers throughout Central Ohio. Welcome to All Sides, Aaron.
Thank you, Anna.
So I want to actually start with an email that we got from a listener named Mike, and says that he supports cities requiring conformance to a brand they've created, that Dublin has a distinctive brand. The Arena District has a distinctive brand, and he would rather have city governments making these decisions rather than developers who are focused, he says, on maximizing profits. How do we balance that? How do we focus on what is good for the community in a way that both sides can walk away happy?
Certainly, communities have every right to regulate to an identity that they deem to be appropriate for their community, both in terms of the types of uses and the quality of uses. I think where, for those of us who are on the private development side, where the frustration lies oftentimes is where the objectivity goes away and the subjectivity is put into place in things like architecture, for instance, which is very hard to regulate because it's sort of in the eye of the beholder. Where you get complaints or where the standards are vague, like in the Dublin case, some of those standards that you really can't quantify from a developer standpoint, that involves a lot of frustration and a lot of guesswork that translates into time and money expended more so than when you have standards that are more concise.
I want to ask you the question that the lawsuit essentially is asking, not asking you to pontificate on the lawsuit, but what does distinctively Dublin mean to you as someone who works with developers? Like, how do you adhere to the vision of being distinctly Dublin when you build?
So I have worked in Dublin for 20 years now, and a standard like this, and we can cite other examples, it's not the single Dublin out, but it's in the eye of the beholder, and even one person in the city that maybe at the staff level may have a different view of what that means than someone that's in a decision-making capacity on a planning commission or city council. And so from the standpoint of trying to get a private project developed, it really creates a lot of guesswork trying to determine what that really means. And I think it can be bent either way. It can be bent in favor of the developer. It can be used by the city as sort of a sword to stop a project. And so, that's a prime example. And I'll go back to architecture again. And Dublin has great architecture, and has a theme of, stone theme and something that, does make you think of Dublin, but how do you apply that to particular projects and how do you get to that standard on that particular project is the question. And that's frustrating sometimes.
If you want to join our conversation this hour about how much control cities and municipalities should have over development within their borders, give us a call at 614-292-8513. Or you can email allsides at wosu.org. I want to say that Matt Stavroff, the developer in Dublin who initiated that lawsuit against the city, declined to join us today because of the litigation, and the city also declined to participate, saying the timing is not right for us to participate in an interview at this time. But You know, it's not that nobody is building in Dublin. I do want to be clear about that, right? The Bridge Street District was a massive design project. Cohatch is in the process of headquartering there with a development lab. I mean, there are projects that get off the ground there all the time.
That this is true. I think that what you'll see in some of those circumstances is those developments are heavily subsidized with public monies in the form of tools like tax increment financing districts, which allow real estate taxes from the projects to be diverted to pay for public infrastructure costs that may otherwise be on the backs of the developer. Which is a tool commonly used and is a good way to really ensure that development is completed at a high quality. I think it is true that in some of the first class or upper class suburbs around Columbus, you do see things getting built. But what you see, especially in the residential context, is those being built to serve a upper middle class or higher class clientele or future resident that, you know, is not enabling those of lower incomes to be members of the community. And so, you know, you see Columbus, for instance, has taken a lead role in pushing a housing initiative, recognizing that our economic growth in Central Ohio is tied not only to our ability to create jobs, but to have places for those people who are going to be filling those jobs to live. And what you find in some of the suburbs around Columbus is that, you know, a certain class of worker is unable to live in their community due to the standards that are in place.
That feels like a good time to take a call from Sharon in Columbus, who wants to talk about transportation and the housing crisis. Welcome to All Sides, Sharon.
That is the first time I've heard anybody mention income. Yes, the Dublin standards seem very exclusionary. Dublin is not a city where you can get there by bus in an efficient way. You can get there, but it takes 2 hours to do it, and you can't stay there for work because you have to leave with 2 hours. You need a car. You need a certain level of income. I have not heard any discussion about the functioning of the city. It's not just about how it looks, but can you ride a bike there without being killed? Do you need a car? It's not just about how it looks. You have to be able to let people live there, afford it, have services. I have not heard anything about density. Dublin clearly is not interested in solving the housing crisis. God bless them. You know, I'm not going to ever live in Dublin. I live in the city of Columbus. There are no sidewalks in my neighborhood. You take your life in your hands if you take anything but a car. And this is something that is not part of the discussion.
You know, I do think that's at the heart of what's happening with Link Us and Zone In, right? Link Us is the ballot measure that Columbus is going to vote on here in November about funding for these transportation corridors. Zone In is about creating these corridors in high-density housing. It is a huge conversation as Central Ohio explodes. I think at its heart, Aaron, I think we're talking about what kind of place Central Ohio is going to be in the next 50 years.
I think that's correct. And, you know, I think a lot of, you know, it's hard for people to believe, but I think we're the 14th largest metropolitan area in the country. So we are, in fact, a big city now. And you know, the growth projections are off the charts for us. You know, I think there's the old saying that if you're not growing, you're dying. I can point to many communities throughout Ohio, smaller communities that used to have industry, and those industries have gone away, and the town is withering on the vine. Coshocton, Ohio is a place where I was born and about an hour east of Columbus, and used to be thriving, a small town that was a great place to grow up in. Not to say it isn't now, but there's not as much opportunity there. So I think we need to embrace what's going on with Columbus, the fact that we have a location in the United States that is central to a lot of things and within an easy driving distance. We have a lot of things to offer here. I think what we're going to see, though, is that we are going to have to expand our residential base pretty exponentially in order to accommodate the growth and not not have that be a reason that it stops. And you know, everything needs to be done in measured ways. You know, so I think things are going to tend to happen more quickly and more intensely if we do it right than we're used to. But you know, with the right controls in place that don't go overboard, I think we can do it the right way.
Yeah, it's what's fascinating to me is we have more people in the metro area than Denver. So we're essentially a more populous place than the city of Denver. Now, Denver, you might think of, oh my gosh, that place is unaffordable. And as somebody who used to live there, yes, 100%. The housing is crazy expensive. But I was really surprised when we moved here 4.5 years ago, how competitive, how expensive homes were in central Ohio. You sort of think, Ohio, houses are going to be cheap, but it is increasingly not the case.
Yes, and I'm hearing more and more that, you know, for instance, kids grow up here, go away to college, and, you know, their parents would like to see them come back, get a job and live here. But, you know, even getting an apartment now is becoming more and more difficult, not only from the standpoint of cost, but also just there not being enough of them now. And so, you know, it's becoming more and more of a problem. And if you underbuild, then obviously prices go up, which exacerbates the problem.
Yeah, I think that's at the heart of what this zoning conversation that the city of Columbus is having. 80% of the city is zoned single family only. There are height restrictions, but that also gets back to this idea of distinctly Dublin. We saw a lot of pushback in some of these zoning meetings, particularly from those who live on the edge of German Village, right? Saying, I don't want a 10-story glass skyscraper next to this historic district. It's so hard, right? You want to maintain the like brand, the identity, the quality of life for your current residents, while also acknowledging that we need hundreds of thousands of units to come online very quickly.
That's right. And it's a balancing act. And that's why people like me have a job. it's not a black and white question. It's gray. It's somewhere in the middle. You know, I do a lot of work in the suburbs, and you mentioned Delaware County, for instance, and can't tell you how many times where I've gone out to try to zone a cornfield for a new residential subdivision, and the people in the subdivision next door that actually their property was a cornfield at one point are all up in arms as if this is the worst thing they've ever heard
of. Oh my
of.
Goodness. So, those meetings are so contentious.
Yes. And, you know, and understandably so, most people's biggest investment is their home. They're protective of it. That's where their family is. But, you know, I think a little more openness to, you know, having neighbors and including developments that are done the right way next to yours will go a long way towards changing attitudes.
Yeah, one time the head of, I want to say it's the Dublin, not Dublin, Delaware City Planner, once got really frustrated in a meeting and essentially said, you know, people keep pushing back against duplexes, against apartments. They're like, look, if you're going to build in that cornfield, it's going to be large single family houses, right, on quarter acre, half acre lots with sidewalks. Basically, they want to live next to upper middle class to upper class residents. And he was like, yeah, look, we all want to live next to the nice wealthy neighbors. But at some point, we have to build for the lower income neighbors.
That's correct. And you know, when you have to build homes on larger pieces of property, it means more land associated with that home, which is more expensive. You know, that gets passed on to the homeowner. It means more pipe needs to be laid, more street needs to be constructed, and those drive up costs. I find it interesting wherever I go, you hear that people don't want to see sprawl, which, you know, is eating up a bunch of land, but then they also don't want to see density. So those things don't really go together. You can't have both. So here again, that's the policy question that's at issue and what every community grapples with.
I think they call that having your cake and eating it too. But
that's right.
I want to take a call from Sean in Columbus, who has some concerns about rent within the city. Welcome to All Sides, Sean.
Hello. Hello, how's it going?
Good,
thanks
how are
for
you?
Having me. I'm doing okay. The question that I had was, as far as like with college students coming back, and this is, I think, the largest freshman class that they're expecting, as somebody that lives on campus. As the last caller said, a lot of jobs are in Dublin, and, you know, whether that be part-time or full-time. And with the biggest class coming in, how, I'm just trying to understand how the zoning affects more expensive housing in Dublin when students may have to resort to that versus the housing that is in the city, including like teachers and everything. What, and I know that there's like lawsuits with Tuttle Mall and stuff. So how does that affect like city living or like the affordable housing thing? What can be done to kind of help that? Because,
you know, I think that's a good point, because what Ohio State has 50,000, 60,000 students. It's something very, so like, it's like a small city moves in every fall.
Yes. And I, you know, I think the university has been at the forefront of allowing a lot of new housing. And, you know, you go up and down High Street and Lane Avenue, and you see that they've done a really good job with sort of catering to the demand that's down there. But the caller's question about, you know, the affordability of living in a place like Dublin, where there are a lot of jobs, I think what you're seeing from a practical standpoint is that those people are commuting in and out to work because they can't afford to live there. And that's not just something that is distinctively Dublin. That's true in a lot of places. But if you think of what that means, it means more trips on our roadways, more pollution, more traffic congestion. There's a lot to be said about, you know, providing more affordable housing near those job centers, that it's good in many different ways.
Yeah, you're seeing a lot of development in Plain City, for example, above Dublin. You're seeing it, you know, above Delaware in like Galena. You're seeing it in Marysville. You are seeing lots of growth in what you would consider like the outer suburbs these days.
That's right. And, you know, land is cheaper, and some of these communities have the attitude that, you know, some of that growth is good for them. It brings more restaurants, it brings more entertainment options to them, because where there's people, there's economic opportunity for small business. And I think you're seeing places like Plain City capitalize on that.
That was attorney Aaron Underhill, a managing partner of Underhill & Hodge LLC. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, how we strike the right balance when it comes to development. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast, female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Zoning codes have been called the most powerful tool cities have for regulating development. They dictate where you can live, what can move in beside you, where sidewalks go, trees, setbacks, height, density. And the city of Dublin has one of the most restrictive set of rules when it comes to development here in central Ohio. They expect proposals to meet a standard that's, quote, distinctively Dublin. And that requirement has resulted in a recent lawsuit alleging that it's arbitrary and capricious. Joining us now is Todd Kinski, former president of the Ohio chapter of the American Planning Association. He's also a former director of planning for Dayton, and before that, Cincinnati. He now works at ZoneCo, which helps cities update their zoning codes. Welcome to All Sides, Todd.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You have quite the CV in planning and zoning and city development.
Yeah, I've been around for a little while. So
can a city be both inclusive as a community and exclusive in the type of projects that it greenlights?
Absolutely. You know, as you said, zoning is the most powerful tool, and it truly is the main way that cities can control the aesthetics of their community. However, as a planner, I have to say that the foundation for zoning is really based on good planning. What we as an organization And I'm referring to the American Planning Association. And here where I work at Zoneco is we want cities to have really good and well-done comprehensive plans. And those plans are ones that involve the community, property owners, and then it's legislatively approved. And then the zoning code then is the tool that implements that plan. So while I don't know all the details about the Dublin case, for me, I think the most important factor is, did the regulations go into effect after the person owned the property or before they bought the property? Because what we deal with a lot, and now I'm talking from my old public sector hat on, is that we would have developers who would buy a piece of property because they had a vision for what they wanted to do there. And most developers know they have a very specific use in mind. They build houses, they build, gas stations, whatever they build. And they want to try to fit that into that site because they feel like it's advantageous, it's going to be a good location. And then they want to bend the plan that's been adopted by the community to fit their use. So I think in this case, to me, the most important factor is, did the property owner buy it later, and then now they're upset? Or if they owned it when the plan went into effect, there is a process for them to complain, to file their complaints, to even challenge that action. So without commenting about the case any further, I think that's really an important component of the case.
You grew up in Portsmouth in southern Ohio, Portsmouth.
Yes.
And we've been talking mostly about growing communities, Columbus, Dublin, those ring of suburbs around Columbus, where they can be pickier about development, perhaps because there are so many applications to do things with the land that's available. There's always somebody who's going to want to do something. But what about more rural communities, smaller metropolitan areas? Do they have the luxury to turn down development they don't like?
Great question. The real issue is that the zoning code really is the document that identifies both I think, the values of the community, and sometimes the values don't really match the aesthetics that it allows to be built, what the code actually allows someone to do. And I know that if you've driven outside of Columbus, you can drive by a business, say a chain store, and it's located in one of the more affluent communities. And oftentimes the details, the amount of landscaping, the quality is higher than it is somewhere else. And I think the bottom line there is that most developers, they build to the code, right? So what I worry about and what I see in a lot of these communities, the ones that are more economically depressed, is they come off as, and this is a term Shelley Dickstein, the city manager in Dayton, used to always use, is dateless and desperate. It's like, we'll take anything that you give us, right? And the reality is that then development patterns are set in a way that they become self-fulfilling because you get one, what I would term air quotes, bad development, and then others follow. And so this is why having really good zoning codes, ones that really are they help you achieve your vision, but they're not so stringent that they prohibit development is really what would I think is best for a lot of communities. But there are a lot of communities in Ohio that are struggling economically, and I feel like they are like painting themselves into this box where they feel like anything that comes, we just have to say yes to. And that is troubling.
Yeah, because you also have to think about one of the things I find fascinating is zoning even dictates whether you have to put a sidewalk down. There was a caller earlier this hour who said, she lives in a Columbus neighborhood without sidewalks. There is no real, and when Columbus was developing, it was developing as a car city. There was no real conversation about multimodal, about sidewalks and bike lanes and bus routes and, train lines. And now that we're so big and so massive, certain cities grapple with that in particular. I used to live in Denver. As I've said, they don't have an outer belt loop. They have a single highway going up and down, and it is a nightmare. It is a nightmare, specifically on like Bronco game days. That like 4-lane highway turns into a parking lot, but they don't have an outer belt. And it's at this point, right? They're at a place where they can't really construct one.
Yeah, it's retrofitting the built environment is difficult. And I feel like You know, having lived in Ohio my entire life, the Ohio cities are really seeing, at least the bigger cities, are seeing what I say, a bit of a renaissance. You know, neighborhoods that used to be places that people didn't want to live, now they're the hot place, right? And so, and as folks move in and, you know, there's more investment, then things like walking and biking and multimodal is really important. But retrofitting the existing environment as it is challenging. And so we're always fighting, one of the great things in Dayton, if you've ever been to Dayton, is that the street, it was designed by engineers and the streets are really wide. So when Dayton adds a bike lane, nobody gets upset. But if you add a bike lane in Cincinnati where the streets are narrow, or in parts of Columbus where they're narrow, then people get really bent out of shape because you have this, you know, it's like who's more important, the car, the pedestrian, the bike, you know, bicyclist. And I think the reality is that they should all be equally important. However, we have a structure and design standards that are really about moving cars as fast as possible. So it's not an easy solution, but there has to be, in my mind, there has to be concessions so that we can improve the vitality of communities and make them safe.
We're coming down to the end of the hour, but I do want to take a call from Jeff in Sunbury, who used to work in zoning up there. You have a comment about townships and the challenges they face, Jeff?
Yes, certainly. Essentially, when a developer will come in some cases, if the township's not willing to give that developer what they want and how they want it, the developer will say, fine, then we're going to go ahead and annex this land, and the landowner agrees to it, into that village, get what they want. And then as that goes on, townships have less and less control on what their citizens believe their township should look like. And I'm just wanting to hear the comments about that.
Annexation. That is a whole other hour. But yeah, it is used by cities, particularly when they are eyeing development.
Yeah, it's a utility-based thing, and in a way of how the law's written, they favor property owners pretty strongly. So that is a very common thing, not just in the middle part of the state. Townships struggle with that all over Ohio, and it's a balancing act. You know, how do you preserve the character, the rural character, the agricultural character of your community, but yet, you know, attract development and not risk annexation. So
And respect the right of the property owner to do what they want, to sell to the whom they want. So you got a lot of competing interests there.
indeed.
The other thing that I think people really get up in arms with about development, particularly here in Columbus, is the use of financial incentives. Tax abatements have come under scrutiny as municipalities try to land big projects. And it's really, the question of who pays the price. We just had a story out last week, or I believe, about how the cost to update the electrical grid for Intel, like 40% of it may be borne by the ratepayers here in Ohio.
Well, I will tell you that in Dayton, I also did economic development work, and I think that economic development incentives are a subject that is going to have a different view depending on where you are. I know here in Cincinnati, they have modified the community, the CRA, which is the tax abatement for new construction by neighborhoods. They set tiers. So based on the property values of different neighborhoods, they've increased them or lowered them, which has been, I think, a good tool or a good approach. In Dayton, I will tell you that you know, they were kind of a little bit below the market, you know, so like you know, without incentives, there are projects there that would never happen. So, and what I like to tell people is that, you know, if when I'm going to build something, it costs the same in Columbus and Cincinnati, it does in Dayton to build, but the rents are not as high. And so in order to make that project work, you know, and I know in Dayton many of the times, but for the incentives, the projects would have never occurred. So I really feel like it's one of those things where it has to be judged, engaged based on the economics of the area. So in areas where the prosperity is really, you know, kind of on its way up, I think you have to start looking at those. But whether or not they're still appropriate. But I will tell you this, everything is more expensive than it used to be. The cost of, construction, labor, everything, and that I think has made it more challenging for developers to be able to build a project, and at the same kind of margins that they've had in the past. It is not easy. If there was an easy solution, I think everyone would have solved it already.
That was Todd Kinski, former president of the Ohio chapter of the American Planning Association, who now works for ZoneCo, a Cincinnati-based company that helps cities update their zoning codes. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to say thank you to the All Sides staff, senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont-Rabinowitz, intern producers Abigail Jump and Kira Kadar, with video production by the Ohio Channel and board operation this morning by Cameron Howard. And as always, thank you so much for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.